Wake up, Hollywood. This is your host with the most, Nikki Carulla. I don't know what's going on with this mute button. But anyways, we are going to jump right into the interview because Eddie Pence is out for the holidays. And we got someone special, really special. Singer-songwriter, artist, producer, songwriting teacher, Songwriting School of Los Angeles founder, Rob Seals.
Hey, man.
Say hello, man. It's good we finally did this.
I'm grateful to be here.
This is going to be the last show of 2018, so we're ending with a bang.
I love it. Yay.
So I just want to jump right in. So where did you grow up? Where did you, like, what was your moment of zen that made you want to become a musician?
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me, and it's great to see you.
This is long overdue. I'm so happy about this. Totally. This is not going to be the last.
Right on. I grew up in Chattanooga, Tennessee. My dad was an architect. My mom was a graphic designer who later became a social worker. And they had amazing taste in music. I had horrible taste in music. They had this insane vinyl collection. And so I grew up...
Like with who?
Well, so like literally there was no such thing as a genre in their house. So, you know, all original Beatles, Bach, Chet Baker, Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Wow.
Crosby, Tills, Nash & Young, et cetera. So, of course, like I would become like a little 80s metal kid because I had to reject all that great music, to find my own way. But neither of them was a musician. I think my dad had played cello like as a kid, but basically there was no music instrument. In fact, my paternal grandmother, I think her parents owned the largest piano store in Birmingham, Alabama.
Wow. But
by the time I was around, we didn't even have a piano in the family. So there wasn't music in the house on the instrument side.
Right.
It's just, you know, reproduced.
Not easily accessible to play.
Exactly, yeah. And so... trumpet was my first instrument. I grew up so outside of Chattanooga in Walker County, Georgia, my little public elementary school.
How far away is that from Atlanta?
About 2 hours, basically. Okay. If you put a pin in Chattanooga with about a 2.5 hour radius, you could get to Nashville, Atlanta, Muscle Shoals. You know,
wow.
So it's,
you're right in the mix, ironically.
Yeah. I mean, like, I wouldn't say there was a great scene in Chattanooga, but you were in the vicinity of a lot of great music, you know, which was cool. But anyway, trumpet was my first instrument as a little
kid.
Was
it like a jazz band or a marching band?
Man, it was like the very beginning. They started the little orchestra. So it was, you know, very sad and out of tune. I think my fifth grade recital, I played like Barbra Streisand's The Way We Were or something like that. Very
That's
rock and roll.
That's not an easy instrument to play by any means. It's so I'm sure on trumpet is crazy.
Yeah. I definitely... I haven't played seriously since I was about 13, and I'll sneak one in on records that I'm making, but I can only play about 2 or 3 minutes now
before it hurts.
Before I can't make a note anymore, but yeah.
That's crazy. So, and then when did you start listening to your parents' vinyl collection and start gravitating towards all
totally.
Of that?
Totally. Well, I started playing guitar when I was about 13 or so, and... I think you're talking about the moment of zen. I think there's just been a series of moments of zen, not a singular one.
I love this, yeah.
But I had that experience of I came home from Christmas and I had this CD I was so excited to play, and I was clearing off all the vinyl of theirs to get to the CD player, and I realized it was an old Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young CD, and I literally moved the original record out of the way to get to the CD player. And that was when I realized, oh my gosh, like I had all this amazing music always, and of course I had to sort of run away from it. So I was, you know, I played in like metal bands in high school with mullets and clothes from the merry-go-round. Very
You're
sad.
Gonna have to
all
show
sad.
Me pictures of that.
We've made sure that the internet has not found that stuff, but but anyway, I you know, my parents were incredibly creative people, and even though they weren't musicians, I think they appreciated the aesthetics of great art, whether that was in visual design.
And they're supportive of it too, obviously.
Totally, yeah, incredibly supportive of it. And I mean, I'm kind of bouncing around, but at the Christmas time, I'm thinking, so my dad passed away, gosh, it's been 26 years or so, but... When I turned 18, he did this gift. He called it, you know, the Tom Cruise movie Risky Business had you know, just come out, and so he called this gift Busy Riskiness, and he gave me $1,000, but I couldn't. I had to invest in something. I couldn't just buy something or whatever. And I waited a whole year, and he was a little nervous that I was not gonna do something. And finally, I sunk it into a PA because when I was in college, I was playing in a duo, and we were getting to the point where renting the PA was, just not,
Cumbersome.
yeah, and just it wasn't good business model after you get a certain number of gigs and everything. And I think about that, and of course, that investment has, just come back many, many, many times over. But the bigger thing was just that kind of endorsement, and
Right.
also. He was also trying to teach me to be brave. And if you're going to be a creative person, you've got to be brave. And I was, of course, like measuring, for a year before I figured out what the investment
Do
was
you
going to
remember what
be.
the PA was?
I do. Yeah, it was in Charlottesville, Virginia, and at Heinz Music Store. And we bought these EV 1202 cabs. And the head fender made a head a Sun, I think, was the company. And my partner had an Audio-Technica mic, and I had an EV mic or something, just
Well,
basic
I feel like
stuff.
there's
But
this era where everything just sounded good and was made
yeah,
well.
it was
And so that it sounds like all that stuff was,
good, thumpy.
tube and just, it had good fidelity. 'Cause there's so much stuff now, you can buy stuff. I mean, I've bought speakers so many times, and so many times it's like you're buying a shell essentially,
Yeah,
so.
you're right. Yeah, I mean, this is solid stuff. It probably weighed more than I did. You learn that sort of like one move, like swoop it up, get it over your head to get it on the speaker stand thing. It's fun to think about that at this time of the year, at the end of a year, and as I have two little girls now, and as I think about the ways in which they'll find their way creatively and. How I want to encourage and push them. It's a
Did
nice
you
reminder.
gig a lot with that PA system? Did you
Yeah.
kind of
Well,
put some miles on it?
we did. So I was in this duo called Seals and Butler. Very clever. I was Seals. He was Butler.
You're like, no, my name's first.
And Ellis Butler, a great friend and a really, really fine singer. And I was more of the player and the writer, and he was a better singer. We did a lot of harmony stuff. But yeah, it's funny. That wasn't the music I personally was listening to. Like I told you I was into the rock thing. But crafting the acoustic duo was really very fun because you had to get really imaginative with your arrangements and think about, before we had a rhythm section, like, how are you doing the bass line? How are you
Right.
handling these percussive elements? And I was really interested in trying to be inventive with the acoustic guitar. So that was really very fun. And it was playing in those circles in those days in the sort of DC area that, there was a duo called Derry Barry and Alasia. And that was Doug Derry Barry and John Alasia. And they had a home studio. And all the artists in the Mid-Atlantic were sort of gravitating there. And so there was this period when we made our first little record that John and Doug produced, and Vertical Horizon was making their first studio
You're like in the
recordings.
scene. This is crazy.
Yeah, Ben Folds was making his first record there. Ultimately, that record didn't get released. It was just a really great, Edwin McCain, if you remember
Yeah,
him.
of course.
And yeah, so there was a lot of great music happening, and that was a thing for a while, the sort of the idea of a duo, and we it was a fun way to think about songs, because you're really thinking about melody and lyric and harmony being forward. You weren't thinking so much about the production. Like
And were you
nowadays,
doing Pro Tools? Were you doing Cubase? Were you
well, I
doing.
wasn't at this point, but John and Doug, in their basement in Arlington, Virginia, they had blackface ADATs in the beginning, so 16-bit, basically like VHS style tapes, and all these bands. So like on that first Vertical Horizon, Carter Beauford came in and played drums in their basement,
That's
which was super
crazy.
fun, and so they did that, and they also had, I want to say they had a half inch analog thing, but they were sort of trying to move to the digital thing at that time. And I didn't start making records until a lot of years later, but that was my first experience
Why
being
was
in a
that? Were
studio.
you just like waiting to get songs? Was it?
No, so a number of years passed. So I my kind of day job after I graduated from college, I was teaching at a boarding school in the Washington, D.C. area. And my partner went to Harvard Law School, so
He's like, I'm ready.
he had a day thing lined up. But what we figured out was that we could fly him down to DC and play all these shows in the Mid-Atlantic, do these 4-day weekend kind of things. So we did a lot of that for a while, which was very fun. And meanwhile, I was teaching, and I ended up going to grad school and got an MFA in poetry.
I
And
didn't know any of this.
is that
This is
right?
amazing.
Poetry. There you go. And but the, as far as to answer your question, making records, I was doing a lot of sideman work, and then doing those like songwriter in the round things. And I know you do that sort of thing. A lot of times, a songwriter is super fantastic at what they do, but they can't really interface with the other players. And I'm somebody, I'm quick on my feet, I have a good ear, so I would in real time.
You're like a real musician, let's be honest.
We try, right? But you know, so I was doing a lot of that sort of thing, and people would come up to me afterward, and they see my record, and it said produced by Rob Seals, and they're like, "Oh, well, you produce. Why don't you produce me?" And I was terrified of that because I hadn't. I was the quote producer on my record, but you know, Doug Derryberry had engineered, and a couple of other great people, Steve Graham and Wade Bainham, and I had been learning from them. But I couldn't have done any of the tech stuff on my own. So at first, when I was producing, I was hiring engineers, and I was, you know, more of the creative director of things, and a band leader and player and that sort of thing.
Well, that's smart because you don't necessarily have to do wear two hats at once, and you can
True.
kind of, wear the producer hat and know that's the role.
I think that's entirely true. For me, it was less about I didn't have the capacity and the skill set yet to be the tech guy, you know. But what I was realizing was that it wasn't a good business model to be
Right.
paying for all that studio time and engineer time and then trying to sort of carve out a producer fee. So I had had one of those Roland VS880 digital recorders. And I basically ended up doing my first project for somebody on one of those, and that was kind of fun. And then I sort of upgraded, won a couple of artist grants in North Carolina, which
That's
kind of
amazing.
funded a home studio, which was great. Yeah. And so the last record I was making before I finally jumped to computers, Roland made a 24 channel, the
I was going to
VS2480 or
ask if it was
something like
the
that.
third. There's a 32,
I didn't
so
go
this is
that far.
before. Okay.
But I would lug that thing, you know, like. I made a record of my own music the last time I made a Rob Seals record a long time ago. But you know, people like Sean Hurley, who was the bass player then of Vertical Horizon, John Mayer's bass player now, and you know, I would like show up at the hotel where they were staying, and you know, Sean would play on a bunch of songs for me, and we just engineer right there in the room, and you know, Jeff Coffin from Dave Matthews and
Yeah.
all these people like that. So and then
What a
eventually,
renaissance of artists and
oh, it's.
just music
Well, you know,
making.
and that's the thing. What you know of all the people you've worked with and played with, I mean, great players just love to be in the company of people they enjoy and love to make music.
Right.
And so that was a I think that was a really fun thing for me, learning early on that you could get really remarkable people to play on projects if you were kind and respectful and
Right.
enthusiastic and hopefully
I think also
good.
the geography plays, like there's an era where geography and timing kind of line up, and
Totally.
that area in the South in the 90s and
Yeah.
even through the 2000s, so many artists were coming out of there.
It's really true. When I moved to North Carolina to go to grad school, it just so happened that there were three major label acts right there in that little town. And there was just so much talent. So there was a great just kind of hotbed of that sort of thing going on. And you know, Ben Folds had been there in Chapel Hill, and there was just all these other bands. And so I agree with you, and I think there's you know, it's funny. Studying poetry, they talk about schools like they really meant kind of areas and times where their people creative people gathered and did really great work. And I think that's true in popular music with scenes, right? And you think of
Right.
Seattle and
And they all influence each other, which
yeah,
is,
they totally
that's what makes it so
it's
great.
so great that way, and it's such a conversation, and the crosstalk of all that is really powerful. So yeah, I feel really fortunate to have sort of kind of needle dropped at some places like the Mid-Atlantic, DC area, the South, and Atlanta area, and North Carolina, and then finally out here to LA. So,
And you mentioned that, when you were doing the duo, it wasn't like your main sense of, the love that you had for music. With stuff that you're writing, did that evolve into, kind of it becoming more of a sense of this is where I want to kind of create and write?
yeah, that's a great question. I was thinking about that on the drive over about so like why does the music that I make come out of me? Because I was never a great singer, and I think I was always a little self-conscious about my voice. So I would compensate with a really complex lyric and a really complex guitar line. And I think in the end, you know, you're trying to move people, but I think it's the long road and the slow road to move people through their head or through complexity. You know, I think just emotion
Right.
is the, you know, immediate thing. And so When I was thinking about like where did that come from, Rush was really the band that kind of set me on the path of music for real. Alex Lifeson is the reason I play guitar.
Wow.
And you realize that's really cerebral lyrics and very complicated music. But for me, it was what I was drawn to was the way he played guitar and all the emotion that was in that
Well, it's
playing.
like they're thinking. That's what I love about that band. It's interesting. I never would have thought that was a major influence for you.
I know.
But what's so cool about that band is they're thinking about the arrangements. It's like
Oh, yeah.
they have such liberties.
That's
And I
a great
think
way to put
that's
it.
the most attractive thing. So it's awesome that that's an influence for
Well,
you.
I think for me in the end, and I never had the squeaky Geddy Lee high voice like that, but I think really what I found in co-writing was what I'd always been looking for. In other words, when you could write in the room with and for a great voice, and he or she could hit that note that you always heard, but you sort of wrote your way around it because you
Right.
couldn't get there, that was just like the lights coming on for me. And then I feel like I was able to ultimately use a lot of what I learned studying poetry about like saying more with less. And I was saying more with more
Right.
before. And when you can trust what's there to do the lifting, then you can leave room for it. And of course, that room is where we feel, that room is where we're moved, So that was the fun. So really, co-writing for me began in earnest out here in LA.
Who were some of the poets that you were just totally moved by?
I had this experience of when I went to grad school. I applied to graduate schools, and the way MFA programs work is you get in purely on the merits of your portfolio. So like your super swell recommendations and your grades, they
Right.
don't really care about that. And I didn't really have a portfolio as a poet because I'd been writing songs. And when I got ready to start applying to programs, I realized, oh, I don't know if these lyrics really hold up on their own as poems. Like I felt confident in them as songs, but so I just did this crash course of just writing for, those months to do the best that I could. And what I realized was I had a real anthology knowledge of poets. In other words, it's like if you only knew music from listening to the greatest hits records instead of like
Right.
deep diving on
Right.
who did they listen to and who did they listen to and that sort of thing. And so I just knew the classics, or maybe a better analogy would be if you only knew classic rock or something and you didn't know what had happened in music for the last like 40 years,
Right.
And so a miracle of miracles, I got into this great program in North Carolina, and my classmates were all naming all the hip contemporary poets that they knew, and I was just sort of,
Like, man, this is
I was
crazy.
like, yes, right? How do you spell that again? And spending all that time in the library. So anyway, long way of saying, E.E. Cummings
I
was
was,
my guy.
dude, we this is how we're so connected. This is crazy. First of all, I started my band as an acoustic duo. Second of all, E.E. Cummings is one of my favorite
Is that
poets.
right?
Yeah. So go on. So I knew, I had a feeling you were going to say that.
Somewhere I have never traveled gladly beyond was a reading in Ashes in My Wedding. And I think what I loved about Cummings was the kind of inventiveness and somebody who had a deep irreverence for rules and a profound reverence for love.
Right.
And I think that spoke to me
It's
in
the
ways.
romance and the imagery and the power of the words.
Totally that. And then some of the more contemporaries, that I got to know and actually got to be in the company of in school. There's a wonderful poet from Iowa named James Galvin that I think is amazing. There's a woman named Louise Glick that I think is great. And then some of my own teachers, Stuart Deschelles is a phenomenal writer and teacher, and Fred Chappell was the poet laureate of North Carolina former. All those were a part of the mix for me. You can't calculate how those things influence you. I think the bigger thing for me was being around so many passionate writers who are working so hard at what they do. When you fast forward, eventually, if we talk about the songwriting school, a lot of the kind of song workshopping work that we do there for me is informed by how much I learned and grew being in the room with other writers who were, that feeling of
What's the
like,
iron sharpens iron, that
yeah,
idea?
totally. Yeah.
Yeah.
And just when you feel like you're totally getting your ass kicked in the best ways by somebody's work, it just makes you just want to weep with both, sorrow and joy for what they
Well,
did and
what's
what you
interesting
could
too
do.
is with your background, it's like you fell in love with music first, and then you studied, the real estate of literature, essentially. So it's like you have this perfect balance. It's like songwriting was just knocking on your door, like, come on. Come on, come down this way.
I started writing songs privately when I was about 9. And a neighbor took me to a concert, and it was like my first time in church kind of experience. Whoa. And I privately was writing all these songs, and I still remember all the melodies and stuff, but I wasn't playing guitar yet or anything. They were all very hypothetical, but I wrote literally albums of
Wow.
stuff then. But I never, nowadays if you're like 9 or 10 years old, you think, yeah, so I'll get a YouTube channel and I'll, but I
Right.
had no, I lived in Chattanooga, Tennessee. I had no imagination that I was going to be a part of the music business. I just knew that songs were these amazing contraptions that you could put yourself into and use them to figure out the world.
I want to play something. So tell me which song. Do you want to play The Plagiarist?
That's a weird thing to play. Yeah, I mean, sure. This is just because we've been talking about poetry and stuff. So th this is, I will say that I usually, since we've lived in LA, I haven't mentioned that I used to make records because I'm so much more enamored of the great voices that I work with. But this is a record I made in my little house in North Carolina on one of those Roland 24 channel things, and it was a poem I took. I heard about a famous author who had gotten caught plagiarizing, and I was just thinking about, like, why in the world would you plagiarize when you've gotten to
Right.
that level? And in the lyric, in the end, he imagines that maybe what you need most when you're alone isn't to create, but to know that you're not alone in that need. And
Wow.
so I wanted to
Got
write,
chills,
yeah,
man.
well, so I wanted to write a song that felt like it had the structure of more like a pop rock kind of thing, but it doesn't actually have a real chorus. It's just a linear lyric
That's
that moves
okay.
all the way through, which was, well, that was the
You
design of
sent it
it.
to me and I was like, "Ooh, that's so intriguing. I want to hear that." So,
Yeah.
let's play that first.
All
This
right.
is Rob Seals, The Plagiarist. Here it comes.
Novelist is no more than a plagiarist who lifted lines that no one missed from books only he read. I wouldn't mind it all that much, but I have written such and such and felt and sounded like my touch when it left my head. It landed on the page prostrate, at its best not second rate. So come to think I am irate, he skipped the hardest part, the lifting all, touching down the strings and fingers and the sound of one's own voice in honey brown, ringing out the heart, ringing out. Undone, rather beat some to the
were playing all the stuff that was major, like, influences for me. So I loved it. It sounded very much like Toad the Wet Sprocket, a little bit of Vertical Horizon, a little bit of R.E.M., a little bit of Dave Matthews Band.
Yeah.
That was Jeff Coffin from the Dave Matthews Band and
Bella Fleck. I'll never forget this. I was at the laundromat doing my laundry in North Carolina, working on this record, and Jeff was on tour. And at this point, he wasn't playing with Dave Matthews. He was with Bela Fleck and the Flecktones. And he's like, "Hey, man, I know you just wanted that soprano sax line. I played a flute solo." And I remember sort of like, I didn't like throw up in my mouth or so. I was just like, "What? What is that going to be?" But then, of course, Jeff Coffin playing anything. Like, Jeff Coffin would be beating on that pot, and it would be incredible. So when he sent me the file and I got it back, I was like, "Golly, thank you."
He's one of those musicians that where it's like, he doesn't play a bad note.
Oh god!
And those musicians are rare. It's like,
oh yeah,
it's crazy.
Yeah, it's not. I didn't alter a thing he did. And also, he's like, "Hey, and I hope it's okay. I felt like it would be cool if you just had a whole woodwind section on this one build. So I just built you that really fast." And it was like, "Thank you."
Yeah, you're like, yeah. But you know what? It's what I love about him is it's like he goes that extra mile.
Yeah.
Well, most musicians don't. It's like, he'll give you those extra takes you don't necessarily need, but maybe you will take something from it just because he's building something, creating something with you.
I agree. I think there is a generosity of spirit about greatness, and when you're in the presence of it, hopefully it makes you want to do that too.
You have that, Rob. And let's talk about the mix real quick. Man, I love the mix.
Thank you.
And you said you did it on like a small little board.
Yeah, I did it on, like I said, that old 24-channel Roland. So, you know, it was digital, but you still had to make all those old school decisions about bouncing to make sure you had enough tracks to do what you wanted to do. You know,
but the EQ was nice.
Yeah, thank you.
And you know what's so cool? It's like a lot of that sound from the 90s that influenced me, it has this organic musical feel, and that's the way you mixed it. It's like you could tell where you were kind of, you know, influenced, like who was influencing you and what you were listening to.
Well,
at the time.
And you know, there's a lot to be said for limitations in any kind of creative setting, you know. And so I cut Eddie Walker is the drummer on that, who played with Ben Folds and others, a great player, one of the most musical drummers I've ever been around. And so Eddie played that in the little living room of this little house that I had in North Carolina, and I'm in the other room, and like we had a neighbor that would just, you know, call the cops if we went too loud. So it's like, "Ed, we need, this is the one. Like, we've got one take left before you call the cops."
He's like, "I'm going to nail this right here."
He's totally. So, you know, I think there's something about the little kid in us that in making records, you know, because like there's a sound in there that, you know, that you were miking something crazy up, or you were playing what if, what would happen if, you know, and you end up getting excited So you asked me before, how did the making records happen? You know, so people started asking me to do it, and as I started learning the tools, I realized that it's just super fun. And as long as you don't totally go down that rabbit hole and lose sight of why you're doing it,
which is easy to do.
It is, because you can be on, you know, you think to yourself, "Oh, how do you do this?" And then 6 hours later, you've been reading forums about how to do something. And that was me for a while, but that was part of my education, because I didn't go to a Full Sail or a songwriting school or whatever. I did that on my time. And fortunately, looking over the shoulder of really smart people, some of whom I mentioned already, who were, you know, generous about explaining, "Well, this is why I'm doing that," and that sort of thing. And
you ready for the golden question?
Yeah. What is
so
that?
You didn't go to a music school,
right?
But yet you started a music school in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Tell me, what was the moment of zen for you to start a music school, which is not an easy thing to do. It's a huge undertaking. It's a thankless job, especially in the beginning. So what made you... want to start a songwriting school in a city full of artists and music schools around, you know?
Yeah, when you put it like that, it seems like a really bad idea.
No, but I mean, it's a fantastic idea.
Yeah,
it's a great school.
It is a fantastic idea, because when Ashley and I, my wife and I, who she had worked at the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts and as an events planner and a fundraiser, and when we got to LA, we were just so struck by the fact that we were just spending all of our time driving from one creative person's house to another, and we just thought, "God, why isn't there just a place where everyone would gather and do what they do?" And so we'd had that thought for a while, and when I had left my full-time job years before in DC, I started doing visiting artist in residence work at schools. So I had sort of built this creative process curriculum that I had taken all over the country and taken to colleges and high schools and middle schools and everywhere. And I would do assemblies and workshops and teach classes and everything. So I already had this thing that I'd been doing. And when I got to LA, you were mentioning Vertical Horizon, and Matt Scannell, the lead singer, is an old and dear friend of mine. And his vocal coach had asked him to teach a songwriting class at a summer program. And Matt's like, I would do that, but I've never taught. Could I bring my buddy Rob in? And so we ended up dreaming up this co-writing class curriculum together, and we taught a co-writing class together.
That's awesome.
Which was the best, because, you know, to spend a week with someone you love and admire and talking about songs with talented people and creative people and everything. And when that ended, then that program just kept asking me to do more and more things. And so I was going through that for a while and really enjoying that. And that was part of my summer, working with a lot of artists privately, working with some great people write their first songs, which is super fun. And Ashley just said, like, why don't you stop waiting for people to ask you to do something? Why don't you just do your own thing? So at first we thought, well, maybe we'll just start a class somewhere. And then as we started looking, I was just remembering that feeling of, like, why aren't all my creative friends in one place? And so that was the germ seed. And eventually, in 2009, we opened our doors, and it's a, you know, facility that you know,
yeah,
in Burbank. There's a beautiful
facility.
Yeah, it is. There's a beautiful recording studio on the ground floor, and most of the classes are there on the second floor. And the people who come to do things there are just really amazing people. You know?
Well, the funny thing is Allie Handel, who mm-hmm. is a close friend of mine and yours as well, she was a seasoned musician. She was endorsed by Fender. She'd been touring forever. And she was the one that told me, she said, you got to check out this school. You
got to
come and check out this workshop, meet Rob, check out the Songwriting School of Los Angeles. And I was like, I don't think that I've ever even heard of the school, A. And B, I didn't know there was just a songwriting school in the city. There are little programs at other schools. I've taught at some other ones. And, you know, I just never knew of a school that was so focused on it. And it was intriguing. Just that alone was so intriguing.
That's cool.
And then I went, and I was blown away by the talent that was there. I was blown away by the environment. And I was really blown away by you, Rob, because, you know, it's very rare. And this is the biggest and best thing about the songwriting school and that you started it. It's very rare that an actual artist starts a school like this. Most of the schools, I would say 98% of them, I'm being generous with the 2%, are started by investors and started by business-minded folks, started by industry executives. It's not started by artists. And that's what makes this school so special, and I think that's what the draw is. You know, everybody that comes to the school is so drawn by that notion that it's like, okay, an artist started this. These are the things that we should learn that are going to make us successful. And that's what everybody, I think the Roots class is probably the most important, I mean, the biggest class and the most important class. And I think that's one of the classes that you teach, right?
The Roots is a class I teach, and I want to talk about a class that you teach as well, because you do it such an amazing job. I appreciate you saying all those things.
No, I mean it.
That means
the biggest difference.
And, you know, you're talking about somebody like Allie Handel, and to me, that sums up what our community is. No matter how successful someone might be, you know, we're always going to be students of the things that we love.
Right.
And I think that is a pervasive attitude. And so, you know, you really get some amazing accomplished people. We have had a number of Grammy-winning artists, Grammy-nominated songwriters, Billboard-charting artists. I mean, you know, the list goes on and on. And then also amazing, successful people in other creative realms. You know, people who have written your favorite movies or actors, et cetera. And they come to a place because, let's face it, songs are humbling.
Right.
Right? You know, I mean, no matter how good you are, there's that moment where the page is blank and there's no note on your tongue and you've got to go through it again. And so I think what we try to do in that setting is create an environment where we're respecting those people first, honoring the thing that we're trying to do, and then equipping them to do work that might matter to them and to other people, and then help them find the way forward.
It's also an environment that's intimate because, you know, I've been taken on a tour to possibly teach at MI. This was years ago.
Yeah.
And I love the facilities, and I couldn't stand the vibe because it's like a cookie cutter. You know, it's just a thing where it's everybody goes to that school and then they get completely turned off from it. But one thing I noticed with the songwriting school, I see so many students that go through classes and graduate and keep coming back year after year just to be a part of
community.
That movement, the community, yeah. the tribe, and that's the best part of it. You've got a studio in the facility that you actually rent out to other artists to make totally. Records and whatnot. Yeah. You give students a chance to get into their studio, you know, sometimes for the first time. I mean, it's intimate and it's also professional, and that's the best combination of what you started. Tell me what that first, you're about to hit your 10-year anniversary.
Oh my gosh.
Tell me what that first year was like, because I had to be tough.
Yeah, you know, the amazing thing when I think about some of those first people are still a part of the community and significant,
awesome.
You know, and not always, not like every season or whatever, but they know to check in. The first class we ran was a teen group. And there were just six of them, but they're an amazing group. And they're all really talented and doing really well for themselves now. And it was super terrifying. I mean, I think the way you start a business is you do all the market research and you do, you know, do a little testing and that. And we're just like, it's such a great idea. What could go wrong?
Right.
But I think there's a little bit of that kind of dreamer boldness about any kind of artist that you, if you really believe in the thing that you're doing, then hopefully you attract like-minded people. And I think the thing that, I just can't say enough about the people like you who have come to teach, and also just people who have come to speak, you know,
yeah.
I mean, gosh, Jill Scott in the early days came and,
wow.
and spoke at a top line class, and it was so inspiring and beautiful and moving. One of our earliest students was one of my favorite songwriters growing up, Stephen Bishop, a Grammy and Oscar nominated songwriter. And, you know, students in quotation marks, I tried to talk him out of taking my class. I was like, Stephen, I gotta come clean, man. I've learned to write songs, listen to your songs. He's like, I don't need you to teach me how to write songs. I haven't written anything I care about in a few years. I want to be accountable. I want to just mix it up. I want a new perspective. You know, it put me in that setting. And to me, again, that's indicative of the community of people who are just pushing themselves to do something that matters. And you know what happens when you get that cross-pollination of genres, backgrounds, ages, you know, influences, something new happens.
That's the best part about art. It's like you have so many different influences and people, creators, coming from different backgrounds. And the cool thing about the school is you have people from other countries. I have a student right now from Switzerland.
That's right.
I've had students from third world countries.
Yeah.
I've had, you know, and everybody comes in for this common goal of just to be a better artist, but more importantly, to be a better songwriter. And I think that's what's so amazing about this school is it's focused on attracting everybody in the tribe together, to work together, to learn how to be a team, to learn how to be individually better than you were when you walked through the doors. What do you think is the biggest obstacle for you as far as what you want to see for the students mm-hmm. and also what you want to see for the school?
That's a great question. I think that the thing that I'm most interested in is, in all our classes, not just my class, is giving people more ways of seeing and perceiving. Because as a songwriter, really we're problem solvers first and foremost, right? There's this thing that I'm feeling or I'm thinking or I'm trying to communicate. How am I going to get it across in the most potent possible way? And I think if you can equip somebody with that kind of creative and critical thinking toolbox, they're going to be okay. And
right.
they're going to find the way to make headway on the business of their art if they're using that same level of creativity. And sometimes it's even other creative aspects outside of their music. You know, a lot of our students are also have, like, one of our students, Meredith Lockwood, has her own jam line, and Danielle Carter has her own jewelry line. And there's so many creative people.
Creativity's
exactly.
Spreading.
And I think that we all understand that we're capable of expressing ourselves in so many ways, and surely learning to write powerful songs gives you the confidence to tackle a problem. You know, so I think first and foremost, I feel like we're doing that. Not everybody's going to stay in the game. Not everybody's even trying to be in the game full time, you know.
But understanding how to harness that creative power and energy.
Definitely.
That makes us all better.
And
it doesn't matter if they're going to be a pop star or not. You know?
I agree. And then they're all, you know, I would hope that they would walk away, not just from that experience, but you know, years down the road and feel a confidence and trust in their intuition and their own voice and a sense of grit and resolve to see it through, because those are the skills that we, that we develop when we're learning how to do this thing.
I got to be honest and tell you, I went through music school and I felt lost in it. Like a lot of times, I felt like it wasn't what I wanted in a lot of ways. And I was taking classes and learning things that weren't interesting to me. And this is the first school, and I've even taught at other schools. This is the first school I've taught at where I actually want to take every class.
Yeah, me too.
Like, I
Me
want to
too.
literally sit in every class and just
Yeah.
absorb and learn because there's not one part of any class that I know that I won't learn from. That's the best thing that you could possibly do. And the coolest thing about the school is people can take classes a la carte. They can create their own course study. They create their own curriculum based on the
Yeah.
classes. That is such a unique way to build your school. Tell me how that came about for you.
Well, we have certificate programs, and we're just really careful not to put too much emphasis on that. With all due respect to all the fine places that do those kinds of programs, the only piece of paper that makes you a songwriter is the one that's got your song written on it,
Right. Ooh,
or the
that's
royalty
good.
statement that's got your name on it. And so there's no certificate that says that's going to make your work any good. So what the certificate then is, you hope it's a map. It's a map to remind you of where you've been and where you think you're going. And you might use it to show somebody that you've been working. But if the goal is to earn that piece of paper, the goal is wrong. And so we're very careful not to promise things that we can't do or we don't do. A lot of people will say, "Can you hook me up and get my song somewhere?" And the answer is no,
Right.
unless you build meaningful relationships, you
Right.
make great art, and you understand that you have to work at this sort of thing. But the people who do that, and they do find success, and it's so fun. I mean, you just have to look at your social media feed to see, students that were in your class or my class a few years back, and oh, this new sync placement, and this new that, and that commercial, and that gig,
I
and
think
then you realize that
one of the
it's
great
happening.
things about teaching for me too is I like recruiting students to be part of a songwriting team or to link them to a gig or maybe 'cause as a gigging musician, there are gigs you're still willing to take and there's a lot of gigs as you get older that you're not willing to take, and being able to connect people to those opportunities, that's the best thing you could do for any new musician, you know what I mean? So I find that there's two great things about teaching. It's like if I teach students, okay, these are the things you need to learn, these are the things you need to get better at. If I teach them these concepts and they perfect them, why wouldn't I hire them for a session? Why wouldn't I
That's
bring them
cool.
in, in a collaborative effort to try and help link their songs to something else? So you've created this unique environment where you've linked up students with masters of their craft and really been specific about pinpointing what it is they need to learn to get better. Do you want the school to get bigger? Do you want it to grow in personnel? Do you want it to grow in concept? Do you want it to stay intimate? Because there's something, and I saw this at the last couple schools that I've taught at, there's something that l gets lost when things get too commercial. There's an environment, there's something that's really nurturing, especially with something as vulnerable as writing music or creating something. When you have this nurturing environment, keeping it preserved is almost the key,
Yeah, the answer to all that is yes.
know?
I mean, I feel that way too. I think the kind of intimate personal thing is critical, and at the same time, there are more groups that we can impact and help and also benefit from. While you and I are talking, I just got a text from a really talented member of our community who's a veteran, and he and I have been talking about what are the things that the songwriting school can do that relate to veterans' experience and self-expression and whatnot. And there's so many things like that that we
Right.
can do meaningfully that aren't that can be very much about the industry, but also don't have to be limited to the industry. And I think also in terms of what we can be doing right now in with the state of education in our country, what a songwriter learns to do at a young age, again, like I said before, is be a critical thinker and to trust her intuition and to learn to raise her voice and when to raise her voice and how to raise her voice. And I think our role in making a meaningful difference, not just in the industry, but in fortifying the tribe to make a difference in their circles. I think that's the real place, where I want us to grow. I feel really good about what we do in the industry part of things.
Great answer. I mean, that you can't ask anything more from the founder of the school. The one thing I also noticed too, you're very hands-on with the students to make sure they're connecting to their craft, to their instruments, getting better, and you create a dialogue with all of them so that I've seen you do it, and it's like I've observed it, and I'm like, you know, most people that run schools or a business, anything, they never do that. That attention to detail, that like nurturing a young songwriter and saying, okay, what can I do to better? What are your interests? It's like you really listen and cater to the student. That is so rare. Do you find that with each generation that music is changing so much because we're not getting it in schools, you know, that marching band that you're in. Maybe your school or other schools like it here or in other parts of the country, they're not getting that education. So I just read an article recently, like music, you know, intelligence is declining. So do you find that you were creating an opportunity for people to kind of also become better listeners, become better artists, because they're also not getting that in the early years of development, you know, to understand music on a deeper level? Is that one of the kind of driving forces behind what you're doing?
I think that's a really nice way of saying that. I think that there was this way back when, 40 minutes ago or so, you asked me what was the Zen moment, and I said, I just had all these sequence of Zen moments. But I knew as a little kid that songs were this magical thing, and there's this relationship. I like to talk about in my class The Roots. I like to talk about the relationship between the mystery and the mastery, and that the danger of pursuing mastery is that you can lose sight of the mystery. When you sort of pull the curtain back and you understand how the wizard makes Oz run, you can for a little while lose that childlike sense of wonder. And I think if you spend enough time down that path, your relationship to the mystery just deepens, and then you realize that you're in on this bigger thing. So I think for some people, we're trying to get them started just so that they can express themselves and write songs, and it sounds like music coming back. And then for somebody in the industry, the hope is that they're not just skilled, but they're really getting to the uniqueness of who they are, because that's what we need. We've got so many great artists right now. But when somebody's got a unique take, a unique angle, a unique way of seeing the world and getting that across, suddenly we all take a step back. Thank goodness that that person was there. And so I think that what we're really in the business of doing is amplifying the truth of individuals, as opposed to like putting our stamp on them. I think it's the opposite. I think we're in the business of turning them up and getting them focused on the thing that they do and are,
Well, I'll tell you, you're not doing something that most schools or people are doing. I commend you for that.
Thanks, man.
And you're also creating this amazing environment that there's a studio downstairs. Like there are levels. It's like the one thing that I love about the school and what you create, it's like no matter what level you're at, you could come through this terminal and learn and create and be a part of something. Where it's not always like that at other schools. I don't care what facilities, you know, other schools have or how big or small another place is, that concept you're not going to find everywhere. So that I think is one of the best parts of the songwriting school.
I appreciate that. Again, I think the people are just so amazing. And I have to tell a little anecdote. I'm working this week on a Christmas song that I help one of our students with, and I'm producing for her. And she had a fellow student come in and sing the harmony vocals. The fellow student is Debbie Boone. Debbie was a Grammy winner for New Artist of the Year. And when I was a little kid, Debbie was this big pop idol. And she's been a working performer all of her life. She's still an amazing singer, and she's an incredible person. But she had never been the writer of her own songs. And here at this stage in her career, she's challenging herself to write her own songs, and she's writing these beautiful, beautiful songs. So I had this moment of, the little kid who was playing trumpet, who probably thought about playing You Light Up My Life at the trumpet recital when I was a little kid. That was the big Debbie Boone hit back in the day. And I'm getting to record her incredible vocal and stack it like crazy. Hey, can we do another double? Just secretly, just because I want to hear her sing.
That's like
more.
The little kid moment.
That's a little kid moment. And to me, that's she's indicative of that attitude at school where no matter what you've done in your life, no matter how accomplished you are, that willingness to keep growing and pushing means you are staying young and vital and hungry, and you're also making the people around you that way. And so I'm with you. There's never a room I walk into that I don't learn something. And I feel like even if a song is totally not happening, I'm learning something in that
right.
moment, right? Because
right.
I'm interfacing with that song and I'm thinking about why isn't it working? What could it do? And how could we get there? And I think, you know, when someone says to me, well, I just wasn't challenged, you know, I feel like there's some agency that's missing in that statement. It's sort of like, well, what weren't you doing?
Right, they're closed.
Yeah. Right. And so the hope is we create environments. And I want to say you do such a beautiful environment. I get texts from the Trey who helps out on your night to say, I love this guy all the time. But you talking about mystery and mastery, you're demanding as you push your students toward mastery, but you are like the little kid with wonder for the mystery
it.
Of I music. Mean, and I think that's infectious and people...
I think we all need that, right?
We do need that.
And the funny thing is my students also inspire me.
Yeah.
You know? But it's the environment you created. So real quick, where can people find the Songwriting School of Los Angeles? List all the Instagram, social media, even the address if you can.
Absolutely. So you can find The Songwriting School at thesongwritingschool.com, thesongwritingschool.com. And that's the mothership. But we are Instagram, The Songwriting School, because Twitter, you can't use so many characters. We're Song School on Twitter and Facebook, The Songwriting School. And we crank up for winter classes in January. And yes, it's our 10-year anniversary, which is very exciting. So we're going to do a lot of Songwriting School X kinds of things
nice.
During the year and celebrating and also remembering some of the amazing people who've come over the years and giving thanks and celebrating, you know, all of their gifts to what this thing is that we do. So, yeah. And so we're in Burbank.
Amazing.
And, yeah, reach out on the website. And honestly, I'm usually one of the people who follows up to meet somebody and find out who they are and understand how we might serve them and bring them into our community. So do it.
Rob, this was an interview that was so long overdue. We're going to have you back.
Thanks
You're
going
to have to tell
me.
Us at the end of this 10-year anniversary, when we're heading to the 11th year anniversary, we're going to have to bring you back and tell us plans for the future. And you're going to have to tell us how you celebrated this 10-year anniversary. That's a monumental thing. Congratulations. I'm honored to be a part of it, even late in the game as I am. It's an honor. And
Thanks,
this
man.
Was such a fantastic interview. You just made my whole year with this interview. It just really was awesome.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate what
of
you
course.
Do.
Of course. All right. Well, on behalf of Eddie Pence and myself and Mr. Rob Seals himself, we'll see you guys in 2019. Have a happy new year, a merry Christmas, a happy Kwanzaa, a happy Hanukkah, and everything in between. We'll see you guys next week.